I'm Kimberly Warwick with Lion and Lamb Ministries, and this is The Lion's Share, our brand new program, and it is my honor to interview our founder and director, Monty Judah. Monty, welcome to our new set.
Thank you, Kimberly.
Yes. Will you tell our viewers, please, what this program is all about?
Well, we have designed this program. We call it The Lion's Share. And so the idea is that we invite people in, leaders, teachers, authors, other people in the ministry to come and share what God is doing with them in their ministry so that the rest of our brethren can see that there's many other laborers in the field.
Yes.
Sharing the faith with one another. And so it's an opportunity to sit down and get to know that leader or teacher a little bit better.
Yes.
And so we decided to do the very first broadcast of this that we would do me.
Yes.
We're going to do a little program on me, the director of Lion and Lamb Ministries. So we'll see how it goes.
Yes, we will. And folks, you're in for a treat. We have some questions for Monty that will really help you get to know him better. Some of you have been following Lion and Lamb for over 20 years, perhaps, and you've heard some of his stories. But through these two episodes we're going to do, Monty, through these two episodes, you're going to get to know Monty at a whole new level and see what really brought him to where he is today. Are you ready to get started?
I never say I'm ready, but I'm open to this.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're open.
I'm asking God, keep me humble here.
Yes.
It's not about me. It's about what he's doing.
Yes. Well, I wanted to start with your family came from the East, and just like many other pioneers and settlers, they came out west, headed to Abilene.
Yeah.
And were really part of the American Westward Movement. Would you tell us about that?
Well, from my father's side of the family, they, of course, were in Europe. And as far as back as we can find, the Judas were in Rome as slaves and then into Switzerland. And through certain events, historical events that took place, they were able to come to the New World here in America. They made their way into Pennsylvania, down the Ohio River, settled in Indiana and northern Kentucky area. My particular branch of the family then made their way to St. Joseph, Missouri, and then by circumstances actually homesteaded in Dickinson County in Kansas. And Abilene is the county seat there. So that's where my grandfathers and fathers, you know, where I Harold from is from the Abilene, Kansas area.
Yes, and recently we took a trip to Abilene.
Right.
And you guided us around the town.
Right.
And we've got to see a lot of places like the old train depot.
Right.
Where you
right.
like to play as a kid. Tell us about that.
Well, on my mother's side of the family, which they came out of England, were part of the Revolutionary War, made part of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in the Kentucky area. And then they made their way to Kansas, Abilene, by way of train when train service first came. And so that's how the Clarks and Browns and Needhams that I herald from made mm-hmm. their way there. And that particular train depot, my maternal grandfather, he retired from the railroad. He was a freight clerk there for the Rock Island Railroad. And one of my first memories of my maternal grandfather is 6 years old being taken by my grandfather to go over and see the station chief and walk on the wooden floor, you know, in that train depot, and to hear the clicky click of the telegraph. You know, they still had that stuff, you know, back then. And that train depot still exists, and they moved it across the tracks, and it's part of the tourist attraction there in my hometown of Old Abilene Town. So they put the train depot as a part of the old Abilene Town tourist thing they have there.
Yes, and you have a story of a relative, not close relative, but a relative, Theodore Judah, who was part of really the train expansion all the way to the Pacific. Is that right?
Right. Railroads became a huge part of my ancestors on both sides of the family. But there's a very famous Judah. His name is Theodore Judah. Yeah. If you ever go to the Smithsonian, you will see a big display on him because he's the guy who was the chief engineer on the Transcontinental Railroad from Sacramento across the High Sierras yes. over to Promontory Point. And his wife was a very successful artist. She did a lot of paintings of the Transcontinental Railroad.
Yeah.
The roadbed, he designed the roadbed for that. And there's a big Smithsonian display about the American railroads and what took place and some of his story. A book was written called Crazy Judah and the Big Four.
Yes.
And what's really ironic about that book is there's a one-page part of that book that describes Theodore Judah's personality, his mm-hmm. character. And it's funny because in my family, when I got a copy of that, I took it back to my family and I read that off and I asked, who is that describing? And you'd be stunned. I was stunned. People were saying, oh, well, that was my grand. No, that's my father. Mm-hmm. You know, it's my ancestry. Apparently, this particular description lined up with a lot of Judah males.
There you go.
Historically. So that's kind of ironic how that all worked out.
Yes, and in fact, when I was researching for this show, I came across a beautiful display on Anna Judah, who was yes. Theodore's wife,
right.
in Sacramento today.
Yes.
In fact, it was just this year that, actually 2024, and back in April, they had a beautiful display of her and her about her and her paintings, and
wow.
mentioned something about Theodore in there with the trains.
Right.
But really had a lot of her paintings, and she was quite the artist.
She was quite prolific. And yes. in fact, some of the paintings are in the Smithsonian, plus what they're describing here. She really, without a camera, she captured a lot of the moments of what was taking place
yeah.
During the formation of the Transcontinental Railroad.
Yes.
So it's kind of an interesting piece of American history.
It is.
As to how all that comes together. But yeah, they're off. There's some of the distant relatives that I've got off mm-hmm. on the Judah side, on my father's side.
Yes. And then you have another interesting character in your ancestry who actually rode the cattle drives on the Chisholm Trail.
That was my great-great-grandfather, William Henry, when he was they lived in the homestead there in mm-hmm. Kansas. Abilene was the conclusion to the Chisholm Trail, you know, the trail drives we drive to Abilene. Well, he was a young boy there, and they came through, and so he was familiar with what that was, and then as a young boy, I believe he was the age of 15, he decided to do that.
Wow.
And so he is 15. And by the way, those guys were real boys. When they say cowboys, they're not kidding.
Yeah.
They were boys.
They were young.
They were very young. Now, older men couldn't endure what they had to do, but boys could. And so he rode the trail drive. He went all the way down into Texas and rode it all the way back up to Abilene. And according to the story that I've been given by my ancestors, my aunts and so forth, they said that as soon as he got back, he said, I will never do that again. And so it was pretty rugged. But he's a real cowboy. In fact, I have a photo of him. I don't know if I can dig it out, but he's got the hat and the vest and the chaps, you know, and so on. He had the whole regalia.
Yeah.
And can I tell you one other story about him?
Please.
He was very proud of that, apparently. And my aunt relayed the story on, which was his granddaughter, and told about how he would go to Abilene on once a week, ride his Indian pony in. We'd go to Abilene and do the shopping for the family. Mm-hmm. And apparently he'd wear that regalia, you know. And he was in town one day, and there was a couple of pretty ladies. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to impress these ladies. Somebody came with a bicycle, the big wheel bicycle. Brought one of those.
Wow.
Well, you know, if you're a cowboy, you can ride anything.
Oh, dear.
So he decided he's going to ride the bicycle and impress the ladies. Well, he got up there, and apparently he fell right off. And when he fell off, he split his britches.
Oh, dear.
You know, this fancy pair of pants he had for it. And according to the family, he never wore that regalia to town again.
Oh.
And
embarrassed
got
him
too
much.
Big for his britches. And so
part of
the American history story, most cowboys don't tell that story, but
that's right.
The cowboy I knew did.
Yes. Oh, bless him. He just had to ride the bicycle, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, had to impress the ladies.
Oh, dear.
So.
He probably would have done better just to stand at the door in all of his regalia.
Well, that's what he did do. He would go to town and kind of show off a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
You know, that he was, you know, Abilene was a very famous town. That's where the original cowboys.
That's right.
Are for the Americana.
Yeah.
And then other towns sprung up and did the same thing, but. The trail drives to bring the beef from Texas up, get it on the railroad, take it back east.
Yeah.
Why these boys would help drive the cattle up to get them loaded on the railroad.
And that was quite the journey.
That was half the continent, half the United States down in the Texas area below the Red River, all the way up to the middle of central Kansas.
Yeah.
Through Oklahoma and the Indian Territory and the whole bit.
That had to be harrowing from time to time, I'm sure.
And the Chisholm Trail is a very famous Western trail.
Yeah.
It was one of the very first ones.
Wow. Just amazing.
Yeah.
So you have trainmen and you also have cowboys.
And cowboys.
Yeah. Family tree.
That's part of the background and so forth.
Well, you grew up in Abilene in the 50s.
Yes.
And what was that like? What was it like growing up in small town America in the 50s?
Well, that's the way you describe it. It's small town America. You know, this is the kind of community where the kids that I was with, we all went to school together. You know, we went in junior high and then high school together. And you knew the kids. It wasn't a massive, large group. In fact, I think my graduating class had just over 100 kids, and I knew them all. And they knew me. And I was very small for my age. A lot of kids were much bigger. I was a late bloomer. I didn't really fill out as a man until I was like 19 after it. But so when I was there, I was known as being one of the smaller kids, you know, for it. And it was small town America. This is the kind of place where you didn't even have to hook the hook on the screen door.
Yeah.
You know, that it was safe. There was the worst crime there was vagrancy, you know, somebody hanging around on the street late at night and so forth. But and people got along with one another. I think there were more churches in that town than were gas stations. And, you know, life was simple and straightforward. And it was, you know, it was from one Sunday dinner to the next. And that was it.
Yes.
It was very pleasant, a wonderful place to grow up.
And you played, as I said, in the train depot and around the tracks and all of that.
Well, there were three railroads that came through Abilene because of its history. There was the Rock Island, the Union Pacific, and Santa Fe. And three sets of tracks that went east-west through town. And so when you went around town, and I used to ride my bicycle, and I had a lawn mowing business when I was a kid. And I'd drag that lawnmower behind me on the bicycle, and you go up and over the tracks. And so I was constantly dealing with the railroad tracks and so forth because of the way that town was structured and set up.
I can just see you with riding your bicycle with the lawnmower behind you.
Yeah, it's really funny because as a young kid, I'll talk about myself here for a moment. As a young kid, I pushed that lawnmower a lot, and it wasn't a powered mower. You had to
A
push
push
it.
mower, yeah.
And I built up some pretty good triceps. In fact, when I
I
got
can
into high
imagine
school, I
some.
could do more push-ups than any other kid,
Wow.
because I'd worked that so hard as a muscle and so forth. And then, of course, when I was 15, I was able to be old enough to go work the harvest. And so I joined a custom harvesting crew and drove combine all summer. And I made the trip from down at the Red River between Texas and Oklahoma and rode the harvest all the way up to Canada, one summer, harvesting wheat and driving a wheat truck and so forth
That's
as a
amazing.
15, 16-year-old kid.
That had to be quite the
It
experience.
was. It was. I came back and I made the same quote. I ain't going to do that again. My great grandfather had made, but it was a good experience. I learned a lot, and got to see the center part of the plains of the country.
Amazing. Well, I want us to turn our attention on a story that we came across in preparing for this interview. And it does take place in Abilene, which is also, of course, as many of our viewers know, it is the home of President Dwight D. Eisenhower. And the Eisenhower Museum and Library and the Eisenhower Home is there. But there is a story that has to do with you and your grandfather, I think. And I've come to call it the Eisenhower Golf Ball Incident. Would you tell that story for us?
That's this is I'm gonna make a confession here. My grandfather and family lived across the street from the Eisenhower family, and in fact knew the Eisenhowers, and not only Dwight, but knew the brothers and the families and so forth of the Eisenhower family. And in fact, my grandfather's home used to be situated right where the steps of the library, Eisenhower Library, is now. It was part of that, just across the street from it. Well, the story is told that Eisenhower, who after he had made Brigadier General, came home, visited his mom and his family, and he was into playing golf in the early days. And so he apparently went out back of his house, and at that time there was just a field there at the edge of town, and he was hitting some golf balls. Well, apparently, he sliced one golf ball really bad, flew over to my grandpa's house, and broke a window.
Oh, dear.
And of course, he came over there. My grandfather greeted him, and Eisenhower was very apologetic. Apparently, said he would repair the window and all that kind of business. And he asked for the golf ball back, and my grandfather said no. And he said, "I'm going to keep it, as a souvenir, because I think you're going to be a famous person." And so Eisenhower gave up the golf ball, and my grandfather had it. Now, when I came along, well, my grandfather had this desk in his house. It was a top-down desk. It was one of those older, and there were drawers in it. And he had put that golf ball down in one of those drawers and had been keeping it for years, all those years. My mother and uncles had grown to adulthood. I was now born. I was his grandchild. Well, I happened to discover that golf ball in the desk drawer. And my grandfather, of course, chastised me. He said, "Don't touch that. Leave that there. That's the Eisenhower golf ball." I'd never seen a golf ball before. You know, I just thought it was absolutely fascinating. You know, I'm a
Yes.
kid, and you know, I'm interested. I think I'm all of the age of 6 years old at this point. Well, the short time after that, Grandpa wasn't around, and there was the desk, and I got in the door, and I got the golf ball out. And I went outside, and I was absolutely amazed that if you hit that down on the walk,
yes.
it would bounce
yes.
like more than any other ball I'd ever seen. And I promptly went out there and bounced it, and it was on a brick sidewalk, and the bricks weren't level, and it hit, and it shot out into the street. And went down the street, and I chased after it, and I watched it go right down the drainage ditch.
Oh, dear.
Right in the drain.
Not recoverable.
Not recoverable.
Oh,
and,
dear.
Of course, I didn't tell anybody. Now, if we fast forward on
many
the story
years.
Way to many years to I'm a grown man. My uncles are senior members, and they were redoing the museum, Eisenhower Museum, here a few years ago. And somehow my uncles, who got interviewed by the local paper, by the new director or whatever, and they told the story about of the golf ball, how Eisenhower had hit a golf ball over, and that my grandpa had had this golf ball. And so everybody was going, we ought to find that golf ball, and we'll put it in the museum.
Yes.
And it was and so forth. Well, they couldn't find it.
No.
And then they were talking about, well, it used to be in the desk, and the desk went to, you know, one of the uncles, and he went away. And so they think that's it. It's probably, you know, somewhere, you know, but it's, we don't know where it's at. Well, when they did that, I figured, okay, it's time for me to come clean. And so I let the family know, my uncles and so forth, I know where the golf ball's at. It's in the Abilene sewer system. I'm the guy that lost the golf ball.
And I think you told me you even wrote a letter to the editor of the paper.
I did. You know, the director, you know, was making a thing about interesting and getting it. And I wrote a letter and to say, no, you're not going to find it. I'm the guy that's responsible for losing it.
Oh, dear.
It would have been really cool to have his
golf
ball there in the museum.
It would have.
That, where he had played golf in Abilene, but it not to be.
No.
So,
probably
I apologize. Okay. God will hold me accountable. Got it. Okay.
Probably good also that Grandpa had passed on before he found out
that
little Monty was playing with the golf ball.
Well, that's the reason why I never confessed it while any of that generation was alive.
You probably would have had, as we said in our family, tanning your hide.
Yeah. It wouldn't have been good.
No, it wouldn't have been good.
It would have been corporal punishment of some sort.
Some kind, yes. Yeah. Oh, my
Don't
word.
Mess with Grandpa's desk.
That's right. Oh, goodness. Well, I know we'll switch gears a little bit here and talk about your grandmother that you've mentioned before, how she was such an influence in teaching you how to pray and leading you sort of in your knowledge of who Jesus was in your faith.
Right.
But tell us, I'd like to dig a little bit deeper into that and find out what kinds of things was she doing just besides teaching you how to pray and going to church. What kinds of things was she telling you that really shaped your knowledge about faith and belief?
Well, you know, this is my grandma Needham. That was the wife of Grandpa that had the golf ball.
Yes.
There in Abilene, and I remember being at her house and sleeping, and the first time I ever slept at her house, she came to me, and she taught me how to pray.
Yes.
You know, we did the bedtime prayer, and that was the first time I'd ever been exposed to that, and she was telling me about Jesus, never heard of Jesus before, And she was the one that said, would I like to go to church? Didn't know what church was. Okay, you know. My mother had, it was, and my father had actually been kind of isolated from that. My maternal grandmother, Grandma Needham, was very strong in her faith. In other words, she would share the Lord with anybody and everybody, especially family members. And some of the family members just really didn't like it.
Oh, dear.
And so they tried to avoid the conversations, and that was part of what my father and my mother, they were in that crowd of okay, we know this is where grandma's at, but we don't want to talk about that. And you know, as I remember those conversations, I remember I saw the witness of her sharing her faith,
Yes.
trying to encourage the family to trust and believe God and to believe in Jesus and be a part of the faith. And instead, they all reacted as though just because she was sharing that, that somehow she was upbraiding them because of their sins and not living a righteous life or whatever.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is, everybody that I knew at that point, nobody was any big gross sinners. There was nobody misbehaving in a real obvious way. We're not talking about alcoholism or anything. None of that was happening.
Right.
I think the worst thing my grandmother ever complained about was that they smoked cigarettes.
Oh, dear.
And oh my, you
Yes.
know, in those days.
Yeah.
But in any case, they basically rejected that. I observed all this. And then I saw the way grandma came to me,
Yeah.
and I interpreted that she was just trying to be loving. And so I received it. And so we prayed together, and she invited me to go to church. I got to go to church
Wow.
for the first time, met other Christian people like grandma.
Mm-hmm.
Can I tell the story about how I got my Bible?
Please do.
Oh, well, they had this program on Sunday nights, that if you're a kid, and that you would come in and quote a verse, a Bible verse, and they had a list of verses. If you quote a Bible verse, they give you a Bible.
Wow.
And man, this was a cool Bible.
Yeah.
It was zippered, opened up, and there were red letters in there for the words of Jesus. Now, mind you, at that point, I can barely read, but I was fascinated with that, and I saw other kids getting it, and I wanted one.
Sure.
And so I asked Grandma and the others, how do I get one of those? And they said, well, there's a list of verses. You got to memorize a verse. And I said, okay, great. I went down this list of verses that you had to memorize, and I picked one out, and it was John 3:16.
Yes.
And I said, okay, I'll do that one. And so I prepared, and that next Sunday night I came, and before the service, when they had then said, I have a verse, I want to get a Bible. And I came up front, and mind, this is dangerous. I mean, in front of the whole church,
Yes,
there
as a
probably
young
was
boy.
all of 30 people there. And I had to get up in front of everybody, and
Yes.
I went up, and they said, okay, what's your verse? And I said, John 3:16. And they said, okay, go ahead. And I said, well, go ahead, John 3:16. That was the part I memorized.
Yes.
And I remember another person mumbling and going, he doesn't know there's words that go with that.
Yeah.
And I didn't. And I didn't get my Bible that night. So I went back that next week, and my great grandmother Clark, who was there on her wall, kitchen wall, she had this John 3:16 verse. So I spent a lot of time staring at the kitchen wall, trying to memorize
Memorizing your verse.
that
Yeah.
verse. And then the next week I went back and I quoted the verse, and I got my Bible,
Oh.
up front. But the most striking thing for me in those early days about faith was the testimony of my grandmother, that whole experience of learning to pray, getting a Bible, going to church.
Yeah.
I was introduced to those things for the very first time. And I was also introduced to that not everybody agrees with this stuff,
Right.
and that there's a little bit of a controversy. But the thing that I saw out of it was the love of my grandmother, and she translated, and that was her love of God,
Yeah.
love of family, love of people. That came across to me clearly,
Yes.
and I interpreted that, and I always saw those as good things, and these are things that you should be a part of
Yeah.
from that.
She must have been an amazing woman.
She was an amazing woman, and can I go ahead and tell you this other
Yes,
part?
please.
When she turned 80 years old, all of us kids showed up at her birthday, all of the cousins, and we got to see for the very first time her wedding pictures
Oh, wow.
back when she was 19, 20 years old and she got married. And let me tell you, my grandmother, maternal grandmother, was a bombshell. Beautiful blonde,
Yes.
I mean, perfectly shaped. I mean, she was gorgeous.
Wow.
Just to, in her appearance, she was gorgeous.
Yes.
And I remember all of his cousins standing around staring at these pictures. And finally, one of them said, "What happened to us? I mean, we got the same DNA as her. She's so good looking. What happened to us? We didn't get none of that." So, you know, I had the benefit of having a very beautiful grandmother and who loved the Lord amazingly. And the her and her sister, they were the focal point within that part of the family. All of the other family would congregate around them, and they were, and I, you know, it's the story of the two beautiful daughters within the family and all the brothers. And so that was the family. And I was around that. I was the first grandchild in that generation.
Okay.
So I got to be around a lot of the adults early on, and I wasn't preoccupied with other kids. I was more interested in what was going on with the adults.
Sure. Wow. Well, by contrast, now we know with the last name Judah that your father was Jewish.
Yes.
But by contrast to your grandmother sharing her faith all the time,
right?
He didn't want to. Can you tell us about that?
Well, he grew up poor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a young man, he went into the Navy, World War II.
Yes.
And came back. He was a sign painter. And he had kind of his character fit into that description, that personality description, as I said before. And he struggled, and our family, when I was growing up, was poor. You know, in fact, we were one of the poorest families there in Abilene, Kansas, because he just simply wasn't able to provide that much, being a sign painter. Later on, he became a draftsman, a mechanical draftsman. Mm-hmm. And had those skills and so forth. But he could paint, you know, a sign. Mm-hmm. And when he would go up and letter a sign, you know, put the letters and paint with a straight paintbrush.
Yeah.
It was mesmerizing. Wow. I mean, people literally would stand and watch him paint a sign on a window or side of a door or the side of a truck or whatever the case. Very skilled artistically, you know, to do that.
Sure.
The problem is he just didn't make a lot of money at it and so forth. But the one thing that that he did from a faith standpoint is not so much doing the Christian thing, was he would read the Bible, though. Mm-hmm. And I remember him sitting reading the Bible, and I remember he would close the Bible, and he would start making these statements. And he said, "We are the people of the book.
Yeah.
We're the Hebrew people. And this is who we descend from." And I remember him saying those kinds of things. And I remember a couple of discussions between him and my mom and about that. And, you know, my father actually said to me later on as I began to grow, he said, "Don't tell anybody about your ethnic background. It might be bad for business and might be dangerous."
Yeah.
About don't let people know that you're from the Hebrew Jewish point of view.
Yeah.
My mother, her counsel to me was one of that I should always be thankful that I was born in this country, else I might not have been born.
That's right.
So that was the sum and total of my spiritual instruction on my father's side of the family, the Hebrew background and so forth. It wasn't really until I was 15 and I was on that harvest crew that I got up into South Dakota that summer and got to work on a farm that was owned by Mr. Hinkle, and he was a German farmer, and he did not like the Jewish people.
Wow.
And when I was driving combine, and for 2 days working his fields, he would jump on the combine, and he would ride with me, and he would just talk. Well, you know, when you're around these farmers and you're harvesting, what you learn to do is you don't talk to them. You just go, once in a while. after they pause.
Acknowledge.
And you just let them talk.
Yeah.
So he got up there, and I remember he was complaining about Jewish people, this, that, and every other thing. Some salesman or business owner up in Aberdeen, he was a Jewish guy. And, you know, and I didn't pay any attention to any of it. I just ignored it. Well, when we got done with his field, all of a sudden he was announcing that I was the best combine driver he'd ever seen before, and he wanted to hire me away from the harvest group. And I turned him down and I said, no, I signed on for the whole harvest and I can't leave. You know, I need to fulfill my commitment here. And he said, well, what about next year? And I said, well, next year's a different thing. He said, well, let me get your name and address and I'll bring you up and you can work my fields, drive tractor and equipment for him. Well, I said my last name, Judah, to him. And he goes, wait a minute, that's a Jewish name. I said, yeah. So, you know, and he pivoted and started for his house. And my boss at the time, he said, get on the machine, drive out of here as quickly as you can.
Wow.
And I jumped on the combine, like he told, fired it up, and I'm driving. About the time I clear the driveway and I'm out on the highway with the machine, I look back, and this farmer had come out with a shotgun.
Oh, my word.
And the boss tackled him and wrestled the shotgun away from him. I remember seeing the shotgun flying out into the field. And then when we came back, the boss said that he had lost the contract for next year because he had tricked him into liking a Jew boy.
Oh, my word.
And that was my first exposure to, maybe there's something to this Jewish background, being Jewish, that maybe I need to be more aware of that I didn't understand.
Yeah.
And then, of course, that was when I began to, as a teenager, learned about other history, World War II history, about the Holocaust, you know, what transpired, what the nation of Israel, you know, and what was happening with it. So that all kind of came into my consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, about that time. But it really wasn't part of me growing up. My family didn't go to synagogue. Mm-hmm. There were no synagogues. In fact, where I was at in Abilene, Kansas, there were two things you really didn't want to be. One was black and the other was Jewish.
Wow.
The good thing that worked for me is nobody knew in Abilene that Judah was a Jewish name. So I was able to kind of escape everything. Yeah. Nobody ever...
Kind of flew under the radar a little bit.
Yeah, I flew way under the radar. Nobody knew anything. In fact, later on, as an adult in ministry, when I went back to class reunions, a lot of my classmates came and said, I didn't realize you were Jewish. I said, that's okay. I didn't know I was either. So it's kind of funny how I just kind of came into this existence. And unlike a lot of other Jewish people who grow up in synagogue, I didn't have that experience.
Right.
But these are things for me that Yeshua has given to me. He has actually given my heritage to me that I didn't get from my hometown or from my immediate fathers.
Yeah. What a scary situation, though, as a 15-year-old. Goodness, seeing that in the rearview mirror, so to speak, with the guy coming at shotgun.
And it was stunning. It was like the first time I'd ever seen someone act in a hostile manner about that. So you're right. It was like, well, that's a new experience. I wasn't familiar with
that. Thank goodness for the boss who tackled him.
Well, he was smart. I think he knew the meaning of my name, and he knew what this guy was going to react. Yeah. And he was kind of hoping that I would just slide through just using my first name, and there's no reason he would know the last name. And anyways.
Wow. Well, speaking of faith, you had a very interesting occurrence when you were 12.
Yes.
And you were still in Abilene, of course, and you were watching the Ten Commandments.
Yes.
And then something happened after that.
Well, let me go ahead and just recount. I remember the family getting all excited about the movie, The Ten Commandments, going to come to the movie theater. And my mom was very interested in it. And they got my grandmother to go to see it.
Yeah.
And I got to go see it. And, you know, I had heard, you know, through my father that we're the Hebrew people. And so, well, here's the story of the Ten Commandments. Yeah. It's about the Hebrew people enslaved in Egypt. And then, you know, we have the death of the firstborn and that green slinky hand coming down there. Yeah. And listen, that was scary stuff to me. I mean, that got my attention. I identified with it. From the Hebrew standpoint, you know, I had heard about God through my grandmother. This was one of the Bible stories. Wow, this was getting my attention. This wasn't a movie. This was a real story of something in the scriptures.
Wow.
and depicted, you know, in the movie theater. That night when I came back, I was scared to death of God.
Mm.
I'm a firstborn son.
That's right.
What is stopping God from coming and doing that thing again?
Yeah.
And so I remember literally in tears that night alone in my bed, begging God to save me, whatever that meant to, you know, I didn't know what that meant. I asked Jesus to save me. You know, that's what my grandmother had said was his name.
Yeah.
That was the best I could do. And so I had this response to the story of redemption of the Passover and the story of the Exodus. So it's a short time after that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember exactly how long, but it was in those same days after that, that I was out front of my house,
mm-hmm.
and it was the early evening. I remember the setting real well, you know, that it had just gotten dark, street lights were on, and it was a very pleasant evening, mm-hmm. and I was just there on the walk, walking down the walk, when all of a sudden, a voice, you know, came to me. Didn't hear it with my ears, heard it inside.
In your spirit. Mm-hmm.
And it was clearly a distinct voice. It wasn't me. That said, what would you do if everything you were told about God was wrong?
Wow.
What an interesting philosophical question to ask, try to answer.
At 12, especially.
And I had no idea how to even approach the question when suddenly the voice gave the answer and said, God would have to save you, wouldn't he? And that marked the very first time that I had a kind of a personal moment with God.
Yeah.
And it set the stage literally for the rest of my life.
Wow.
Because what I have discovered in the course of my life is that much of the religious instruction that I received as in my youth and young and adulthood basically is wrong.
Yeah.
You know, that we Christians have a certain culture mm-hmm. to us and so forth. The Bible is written from the Hebrew standpoint. It's not written from a Roman Greco standpoint.
Right.
And a lot of people, you know, it's very difficult for you to see your own culture and to understand mm-hmm. what your own culture does to you. And Christians have a culture about them, and that culture is not the culture of the Bible.
Right.
And making that transition from a basic Christian educational experience mm-hmm. and then finding out what's the Hebrew point of view yeah. of what the scriptures and so forth is stunning. And so my life, my ministry has been about making that transition. And it's, and I'm reminded frequently about that first experience of that voice. And I believe it was the Lord.
Yeah.
I believe that he was kind of foretelling me something that was mm-hmm. going to be happening in my life.
Yes.
You know, I go back and I look at the story of Joseph, you know, who got dreams early on. And it guided him later on in his life
mm-hmm.
as to what he was going to do with his brethren. And I kind of view it the same way, that he gave me something early on that set the stage to understand certain things that would be happening later.
Set your feet on a path.
Yeah. And I wasn't even sure what the path was, and I wasn't even sure where it was going. But I had a sense, we're going to be doing something here that God has decided to do.
Indeed. Wow. At 12.
At 12.
Wow.
And basically, when I came out of high school, before I went into the Navy, while I did go to church on a regular basis, my mother also was spiritual. And as I grew more, she didn't necessarily agree with Grandma, but she too was spiritual. She believed in the Lord. And going to church was a weekly experience. I was in mm-hmm. youth group and had kids that were, so I was in that, you know, environment. But I got to tell you that when I came out of it as a young man, I'm 18 years old, I'm in the Navy, if you walked up and asked me if I believed in God, I will tell you exactly what I would say. I said, I think so, but I don't know.
Yeah.
And it wasn't I was trying to be agnostic. It's just, it didn't make sense to me.
Right.
And I had recognized by that point that I didn't really believe in Jesus because of what my grandma said. I believed in my grandma.
Right.
I believe my grandma loved me. So it's not that I believe in Jesus. I believe that my grandma.
She wouldn't steer you wrong.
She wouldn't steer me wrong. And when I had heard the people in the church talk about making a decision, mm-hmm. well, yeah, I had joined the church. I had gotten baptized. You know, I said all the things they told me to say.
Right.
But inside of me, there was still big question marks about who is the Lord and what does the Lord have to do with me? It wasn't until later, as a young man in the Navy, when I was confronted by a fellow sailor, and he shared the faith with me a little bit, that he took me to the point of a sinner's prayer, a personal, you know, that. And when I did the sinner's prayer, it hit me. Oh, my gosh, that's what I did. The night that I cried out to God and asked him to save me after I saw the Ten Commandments, that's what happened. And I didn't have the connection. There wasn't enough spiritual training education to explain it to me until I'm a 20-year-old young man, and then I suddenly said, oh, what I did was I called on the name of the Lord.
Yes.
And believed in his promise for forgiveness and the gift of eternal life. And then suddenly that's when I received it. And, you know, and looking back, I see God was there with me protecting my life.
Yes.
Through all my teen years until I got to be a man.
Mm-hmm.
And I look back and I had a sense that he was there protecting me, even though I wasn't that conscious of it.
Yes. Well, amen to that.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about your decision to go into the Navy. You were in high school, graduate high school, and you make this decision to go into the Navy.
Yes.
What was that like, and how did your parents react to that?
Well, my father had been in the Navy. I had an uncle that had been in the Navy. My other uncles had been in the military in World War II. And so, Dwight Eisenhower was from my hometown. So the idea of World War II history was a very common thing in recent in them. And what my parents and the adults had talked about, I overheard and so forth. And because I was growing up in a poor setting and it was bad, and I didn't want to be poor anymore. And I said, I got to figure out a way to get out of here and go do better. And going to the Navy just really struck me as the way to do that, you know. And so as I got into high school, I began to explore that, talk about that. And by the age of 15, if they would have let me go in the Navy, I would have done it.
Yeah,
that was how committed was. Now, waiting until I was 17 years old to do it, I read every book in the high school library and in the city library that had anything to do with Navy, sailors, ships, whatever.
Wow.
And I became pretty educated
on
that and World War II naval history. The movie Tora, Tora, Tora is based on the John B. Tolan book called World War II in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
I read that whole book
as
a kid, you know, and when I saw the movie, I could recount the lines. I mean, that's how interested I was in the subject. And my goal, I wanted to be associated with aircraft carriers, go to the South Pacific. I wanted to see these places where all of this history had taken place in the Pacific campaign of World War II. So by the time I hit 17, I went down to the recruiter and I said, I want to join the Navy. As soon as I graduate high school, I want to go in the Navy. The Vietnam War was cranking up at that point. And every young man like me was, if you goof off after high school, you can get yourself drafted.
Mm-hmm.
You better figure out what you're doing.
That's right.
College and get a deferment or enlist or whatever. Well, my problem was solved. I wanted to go to the Navy right from the beginning. And so I got all signed up. I took the oath while I was still a senior in high school.
Wow.
And by the, and then that summer, immediately after I graduated from high school, I went off to boot camp to be part of the Navy. Wanted to be around airplanes and aircraft carriers and so forth. And the Lord was gracious to me and fulfilled that, allowed me to go and do those things.
Yes, indeed. And so as a mother, I'm wondering how your mother took that.
I think she knew the Vietnam War was going on and that her son was going to have to be a part of that, just like she had seen her brothers were part of World War II. It was kind of an inevitability thing, I think, with her. She just wanted me to get myself in a position where I'm not in that much danger.
Sure.
And being on ship in Vietnam probably was a little bit safer in her mind, so I think she was okay with it. I think my dad was stunned that I had the gumption to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think he had a strong opinion of me and the leadership that had been built into me. I was very respectful to him. I was very docile, very humble around him. He hadn't really seen me assert myself.
Right.
And when the word came back that I had joined the Navy, he was like shocked. It was the first time he'd ever seen me really assert myself as a person to do something. I'd just been a kid going to school all the time of his life.
Wow.
So, but I think he was proud of me.
Sure.
You know, and I kind of, you know, and I'm not taking credit for it. It's just this was the dynamic. My brother, he also joined the Navy because his big brother went into the Navy partly. My sister joined the Navy.
Wow.
My youngest sister joined the Navy because her big brother went into the Navy. And so, when I came back, I was a very proud young sailor, you know, and it was esteemed in my family that we had done this. We had gone to the service, and it was a very, very positive, esteeming thing.
Well, that's awesome.
My sister got married to a guy in the Army who retired from the Army, and so they went off that way.
Well, I know that in the Navy, you encountered, and you alluded to it a little bit ago, but you encountered someone who was serious about leading sailors to the Lord.
Yes.
And this was the Navigators program.
Yes.
Talk to us about that a little bit.
Well, I'm stationed on board at that point, the USS Kitty Hawk. I've been in the Navy about 2 years. And I meet another young sailor who's like me. Mm-hmm. We were in the same specialty. He worked in one radar shop. I worked in another one. And he approached me one time and began to share the fact, you know, just like grandma would, but only he was very tactful and very diplomatic.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to go ahead and kind of let him have his say. And he shared a couple of verses. He could quote some scripture because he was in a program called the Navigators, which was a one-on-one discipleship training program.
Yeah.
And he had been trained in that a little bit, so he had some skills. He knew the Bible. He had, and he could quote from the Bible. And so he shared about that with me, and I suddenly found that what he was saying made sense. It tracked with previous things I'd heard. But at that point, I had admitted, and that literally, I had had this prayer with God 2 weeks before I met him.
Mm-hmm.
In which I had said to the Lord, I said, Lord, I think you want me to believe in you, but I got to be honest with you, Lord, I don't know enough about you to believe in you.
Yeah.
I just don't know why I would want to believe in you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I acknowledge you there. You can do whatever you want, God. I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have enough information to believe in you.
Yeah.
I remember praying that 2 weeks later, here this guy shows up.
Here he comes.
And he proceeds to share, and he shares a particular verse with me. He quotes a verse. It's 1 John 5:11-12. This is the record that God has given to us, eternal life. This life is in His Son. He who has the Son has life. He who does not have the Son of God does not have life. Now, he said those words, and it is like a giant light bulb went off in this big room in my head, and
wow.
I went, oh my goodness, that makes sense. That's right. That's the reason why he came out of the grave. He proved he had eternal life. I mean, just there's a whole flood of thoughts.
Wow.
That began to go through my thinking of all the previous good things I had heard. All of a sudden, they all took their proper place. Okay. And I went, well, this is great. I said, well, how do you get him? I mean, if you have the Son, you have the life. Well, how do you get him? And I remember, and of course, he was a little confused. He said, no, wait, no, don't get ahead of me. For all have sinned. I said, I know about that. Yep. Don't worry about that. Answer my question. How do you get him in?
That's right.
And he said, well, you invite him. I said, you invite him? I said, yeah, you just open up and invite him. You ask him. And basically, he led me through a sinner's prayer. And I remember immediately afterward, I did this. I already did this. I just didn't realize what I'd done.
Yeah.
And at that point, I began to form a relationship with him. And he began to introduce me to, in fact, I got a Bible. He began to introduce me to a whole host of other concepts. The Navigator ministry is a discipleship training ministry. It was perfect for me at that point because I got introduced to other brethren. I got introduced to other men that believe in God, Bible study, prayer, fellowshipping with other brethren, learning the commandments of the Lord and learning to obey the Lord, and witness and share my faith, you know, with other people. And so I got immersed into being discipled, and this guy was helping me with that initially.
And this was all on the ship, correct?
This was on ship. Yeah. Now, what's ironic is I was only on that ship for another couple of months when I got transferred down into the San Diego area. And when I got transferred down there, well, he put the connection together, and I was introduced to a staff representative for the Navigators, and his name was Cecil Davidson.
Yes.
And he was in San Diego, and he was responsible for all of the different Navigator functions that were going on the different military bases. In San Diego, there's Marines, there's several Navy bases and ships and Naval Air Stations, and so there was a collection of different sailors and Marines that we were with, that we were all, you know, learning the faith together.
Sure.
And so that was perfect for me because it was a little bit regimented. Jokingly, we used to refer to the Navigators as the Never Daters. Because the understanding was if you're doing the Navigator thing and you're being discipled and you're learning, well, you don't have time for girls.
No.
You know, you need to be trained. You're learning certain things. And they had a series of instructions we went through to the point to where that I was able to lead other sailors to the Lord and also teach them the same things that I was learning. And it was a spiritual multiplication kind of teaching and so forth. I was with the Navigators, you know, for about 5 years. And I went through the whole course of the training and teaching, went to many conferences and training programs, knew a lot of different men who were part of me and men I shared with others. And that was part of my very early serious adult spiritual training.
Yeah. And Cecil was responsible for bringing loads of people to the
he was a pretty famous fellow. The Navigator organization was first started by a gentleman by the name of Dawson Trotman. He was apparently was in Long Beach, and the Lord had put it on his heart to minister to all the people of the world in the United States. Well, he ended up having sailors being invited to his house, and then he would teach them, and they would go out and teach others. And he was very prolific at training up. Now, Cecil Davidson, as I understand it, was one of the men that had been trained by him in Long Beach.
Oh, wow.
One of the original early on guys. And by the start of World War II, this is back in the 30s, by World War II, there were Navigator sailors that had spiritually been trained. They were all over ships of the sea. They were in the pervasive in the Navy and the Marines.
It's amazing.
It really was. And when you hear the story about this man being convinced that he had the commandment, he was to make disciples in all nations.
And he really did.
He really did. And he trained other individuals to do it. Now, this is minus, you're not part of a church.
Right.
You're learning to walk before the Lord, you personally.
That's right.
And to encourage and then strengthen another person to do the same. And mm-hmm. for a guy on a ship, this is perfect because we didn't have a lot of churches. We had chaplains and so forth. So if you were going to walk out the faith, why, you needed to learn how to do this independent and not be relying on other people.
That's right.
You know, to have the discipline.
Yes.
You know, for it. And it was very disciplined, very regimented kind of instruction. We had to memorize verses every week, and we had to, navigator guys would walk up to a navigator guy and go, okay, give me your verse pack. What's your latest verse? And check you on your verse, and they'd say, give me the name of the last guy you led to the Lord. You better have a name.
Oh, boy.
And then if you gave the name, you'd say, okay, what's his status? Yeah. You know, how's he doing? Is he getting with the program? And we never, as navigator, it was high commitment.
So there's real accountability there.
Oh, lots of accountability. And one of the things that you would never say to a navigator guy, take it easy.
They didn't believe in that.
What we would say is, hit it.
Yeah.
Get with it. Get serious about your faith. You're in training here.
Wow.
Well, I was in that world for 5 years.
Yeah.
And to this day, some of the principles of steadfastness and commitment, wholeheartedness, and so that's where I learned those things applying to the faith. So when I read a verse or hear a verse like, whatsoever you do, do it wholeheartedly as unto the Lord, not unto men, I'll tell you where I learned that. I learned that back with those navigator guys, because that's the way we approach things. That's the way we learn to live our lives.
It's amazing.
And so it was a tremendous personal spiritual training program for me to go forward into the rest of my life.
Wow. Truly amazing. Well, you spoke of San Diego.
Yeah.
And I know that once you got down to San Diego, you met a young lady.
Yeah. Yes.
Who would become your wife.
Yes.
And subsequently have two children, Anne and Ephraim.
Yes.
Tell us how you met Lynn.
Well, first of all, I had to leave the navigators, because that was the only way I was going to be able to date.
Yes.
And I, of course, you know, I'm here at the time, I'm 27 years old, and I'm not going to go to the bar scene, and I don't know where to go. You know, I did join a local church, and okay, there was nothing happening there. you know, I just didn't know what to do. Well, one of the things that I had done was I had joined the Big Brothers organization. Yes. I had a little brother and so forth. Well, as a result of doing that and the families that I met, they had a daughter that they saw me as a good guy. Mm-hmm. And they wanted their daughter to get interested in me, and I could tell this ain't going to work. I could see the setup. This ain't going to work. And to fend off their family, that daughter at her workplace met who was going to be my future wife, Lynn, and said, hey, I know this sailor. He's a nice guy. My family's trying to get me to get interested. I'm not interested. Would you like to go on a blind date with a nice guy sailor?
Yeah.
And she was young and adventurous, and she, too, had never been on a date.
Wow.
And she was 19. And so I got a phone number, and so we had a blind date. And it was like destiny. In fact, I met Lynn on a blind date. We went to a movie, and we talked for 2 hours.
Wow.
Afterwards, and we announced our engagement 12 days later.
Wow.
And we were
married. That I did not know.
We were married. We delayed that a little bit. We got married within the next 3 months.
Yeah. But wow.
And
you knew.
Yeah, just knew.
She was the one.
And she was 19, I was 27, and she was wise for her years and so forth. And that's how we got married.
And subsequently?
Subsequently, I left the Navy after a while.
Yes.
I married her the last year I was in the Navy.
Okay.
And I didn't want to subject her to being a Navy wife, and because I'm staring into going to sea again and other things. And so I decided I'm going to get out and get a civilian type job. And I did. I got a contractor type job. And so we could be at home.
Yes.
And that's essentially how we proceeded to go from there.
And you did. You transitioned from the Navy to the corporate world.
Yes.
And that's where I think your technical engineering
Been a radar technician in the Navy. And at my last period in the Navy, I got very involved. I was with the F-4 and F-14 programs. Mm-hmm. And the F-14 program was a new airplane at that point. And yes. I got involved with not just being a technician and running a radar shop, but actually making some modifications and adjustments to the thing. And I ended up working with the Grumman engineers and Hughes engineers and the Admiral staff. And it was really unique that I got an opportunity to do that. But so when I stepped out, I kind of knew what the aerospace contracting world was all about.
Yeah.
And so I was able to secure and get a job very quickly because I had some credentials and history of doing those kinds of things. And so when I first stepped out, I was a technical writer. I had helped rewrite technical procedures for the F-14. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to step into that kind of work environment, which is logistics engineering. That's one of the disciplines.
Yes.
In the course of the next 15 years, well, I had a career being a logistics engineer, working my way up through different programs, primarily Air Force programs, not Navy, but primarily Air Force programs. I always tell everybody I had like a 25-year career in the military, 10 of it in the Navy, active duty, and 15 with the Air Force in satellite programs, and kind of worked my way up, through that.
Yes, and you've told stories before about your climb in the corporate world and how you eventually got to be a vice president and at that level.
Yes.
But shortly then after that, you began to feel, I think, a call to the ministry.
Yeah, let me go back to my navigator experience. Young man, I'm getting serious about the Lord. I'm learning about the Lord. And that fellow who had introduced me to the Lord to begin with, it was probably in the first year I was with the navigator. He came to me one night and he said, Monty, he says, I've never done this before, but I feel led of the Lord. I'm supposed to do something for you. And I said, okay, you know, what? And he opened up Deuteronomy chapter 8.
Yes.
And he said, Lord wants me to tell you that the verses in this chapter are about your life.
Wow.
That as you go through your life, this is about your life. This will guide you. Well, that was kind of interesting. I read the first couple of verses that, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. And I'm going, okay, and I'm trying to learn, all that. But there was another verse later on in the chapter that said, I will give you the power to gain wealth in your hands so that I might confirm the covenant I made with your fathers.
Wow.
Now, that first part of that verse about gaining wealth, power to gain wealth in your hands, I was really interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was desirous of that. Having grown up poor and being a poor sailor at the time that was all going on, whatever that meant, Lord, I was interested in. I did not want to be a poor man, a man always in need. That would be a wonderful promise. Now, the second part of the verse didn't make any sense to me, and I just ignored it. But later, as I got out of the military and got into aerospace, all of a sudden I'm seeing, you know, my career take off. I'm increasing, I'm getting bigger and bigger pay raises, I'm getting better and better positions. And I'm remembering him giving me the power to gain wealth in my hands because I was writing proposals.
That's right.
And I was writing technical documents and engineering documents, and that this was how I was gaining wealth, the power of my hands, if you will. But as we come toward the end of my career, toward the end of it, and as I'm maturing the faith, the second part of the verse starts to kick in, that he might confirm the covenant he made with his with your fathers. Now, I knew my fathers were Hebrews.
Yes.
And that was perplexing. Like, what does that mean? You know, at that point, I was a pretty navigator. I'm a good Christian. You know, I'm a good Christian. I go to churches, sometimes Baptist churches, whatever. But what's this? What's the second part of the verse? I mean, he gave me this ability, and he took me out of need to do that. And this is what led me to, in 1984, to have another one of these very interesting experiences with the Lord.
Yes.
And like unto when he had come and talked to me when I was 12, and like unto when the Bob Michaels had come and spoken with me and given me these life verses.
Yes.
All of a sudden, you know, I am having this interesting experience. The only way I can describe it is that for 2 weeks, in fact, in August of 1984, I was on trips. And when I would go on a business trip, when I'd fly, that was when I'd do my Bible reading time.
Sure.
You know, I'd get on the plane, pull my Bible out, and I'd spend extra time reading. And I would open the Bible up, and all of a sudden, the best thing I, the way I can describe it, it's like suddenly I understood. It's like I didn't learn it by process, and suddenly it was all there.
Yes.
It was like he just took all this information, plugged it in.
By the Spirit.
Yeah, and it's there.
Yes.
And I'm flipping pages through the Bible, and I'm like reading with perfect understanding. And I, in that 2 week period, I learned the whole Bible over again.
Wow.
And I was a completely different guy at the conclusion of it. Let me just a shortened version of it.
Yes.
I saw the prophecies of what we call the Messianic movement today. I saw how God had not only had brought the nation of Israel back into existence, but how he spiritually was going to bring the children of Israel scattered throughout the nations back to faith in him, that they we'd turn to the Lord. Well, I was one of them. I had this Hebrew background, didn't know about it. He's bringing me out of the woodwork. He's bringing me forward to be one of the sons of Israel that believes in the Messiah. And there would be this messianic movement. There would be many people coming to faith and so forth. And it was an exhilarating experience, to say the least. And in fact, at the end of the 2 weeks, it was exhausting. It was It stretched me out. I became fearful that I was not having a single thought that was my own personal thought.
Wow.
And I remember the prayer. I prayed, "Oh God, you got to shut this off. I think I've read one too many Bible verses. I'm going bonkers."
Oh.
Quote, end quote.
Yeah.
And like that, it stopped.
Wow.
And I went, okay. Now, what have I got here? What have I received? What's my understanding of it? And so forth. But the one thing that really came across was I had learned enough of the principles of the faith that if you think you have a certain understanding about God, that you think God has given to you, it has to be confirmed. You can't just run off with that.
Right.
And I said, "Lord, I believe you've given me a lot of things here, but it needs to be confirmed. Yeah. I need to have another person that can confirm these things with me."
That's right.
And I prayed about that. And 2 weeks later, I get to meet another man who's very important in my life. His name was Eliezer Urbach. Mm-hmm. And Eliezer Urbach at that time was in Denver. I was in Colorado Springs. He was a representative for the American Board of Missions to Jews, Chosen People Ministries, as it's called mm-hmm. today. And he was the regional guy there. And his own testimony mm-hmm. is quite a testimony. He was a survivor of the Holocaust.
Yes.
Lost his family in the Holocaust. And ended up making his way out of the Holocaust mm-hmm. and Europe. He ends up accepting the Lord while in being in Brazil, makes his way up into New York. He, too, is trained by another Jewish believer mm-hmm. in New York, and then from there is sent out to Denver, Colorado,
right.
As a representative of that organization, him and his wife, Sarah. Well, he came to a local church and spoke one Sunday night, and I went to hear him speak. And I walked up to him afterwards, and I said, Eliezer, I said, I'd like to have the opportunity to sit down and meet with you a little bit. I need to have some questions. And he said to me, he said, what's your name? And I said, Monty Judah. And he said, Judah, where'd you get this thing? And I said, from my father's, just like you got your name.
Yes.
He said, we need to talk.
Yes. And on that note right there, that's our cliffhanger. So, folks, I want to tell you, we have had such a great time with talking with Monty today. And I hope you've had a great time with us learning all of these stories that Monty's told about growing up in small town Abilene, going to the Navy and then corporate America. But we have the best part of the story is coming in our next episode, part two with Monty Judah, and you are going to find out all about his transition to the Messianic faith and this very important gentleman that came into your life, Rabbi Eliezer Urbach. And so we'll leave it there, and Monty, we'll see you next time.
All right.
Would you close us in prayer?
All right. Father, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to share some testimony about you. Lord, I pray that possibly something that I may have said, what you've done with me, would be an encouragement to another person also. You're in the business of working with us personally and getting to know us. And so, Lord, we appeal to you at the personal level. Thank you for personally sending your son to be our redemption. And we pray in his name for all these things. In Yeshua's name, amen.
Amen. Thank you again for such a wonderful time with you. And folks, we'll see you back right here on The Lion's Share.